So you think just because Biden lost one election, that means that, you know, MAGA Republicans rule the country and that Democrats have no chance of winning unless they become authoritarian themselves?
I think Democrats will win the next set of elections, but I think the fact that Trump won says something is deeply wrong with the American public right now and is deeply wrong with our discourse. The reality is that the president makes on a daily basis unhinged tweets that would dwarf the entirety of an ordinary Democratic president's tweet history combined.
Claire, you think if Democrats get into office, they should do a January 6th style insurrection, because conservatives already did it, right?
If we do it, hopefully we don't fail like they did. Okay. I think that there need to be severe repercussions for the current administration, mm-hmm. because right now the pattern that we've set in the United States is that if you're a conservative, you can do basically whatever you want, and at the end of the day, the Democrats are going to show up to not only clean up your mess, but pretend you didn't do it and then try to play along with you.
Good evening, everyone. Thanks for coming out. My name is Aiden Flynn, and I'm with Yale Effective Altruism, and I'll be your host for tonight's event, a series of live debates between Stephen, Bennell, and Yale students. Stephen is a political commentator and streamer known for long-form live debates on public policy, philosophy, and internet culture. He's built a large audience by arguing with people who strongly disagree with him. And tonight, we have some students who are ready to challenge him at Yale. So give it up for Stephen Bennell. For our first round, the topic is, the United States should abolish Medicare and Medicaid. Joining Stephen for this round is Hassan Kadir, from former chairman of the Party of the Right. Hassan will be defending the claim that Medicare and Medicaid should be abolished and the government should not be involved in the healthcare market. Stephen will be opposing this view. Hassan, you have the floor to open this round.
Thank you, Stephen, for being here, and thank you for Yale Effective Altruism for giving us all this opportunity. I hope we have some very interesting, informative debates. So I guess just to start with my claim, I think we should understand that in the status quo, Medicare and Medicaid combined, and I'll be mainly talking about them combined today, are around $1.9 trillion of annual spending in the federal budget, which accounts for around 20% of the American federal budget and 40% of all of American healthcare spending. It's impossible for us to talk about healthcare spending and healthcare reform without directly addressing Medicare and Medicaid. Yet despite all this spending, we find that the United States has the lowest life expectancy amongst all the developed countries. Why is this? One argument that I'm making is that much of the spending in Medicare and Medicaid, in fact, around one-third, is estimated to be of absolutely no clinical value. This is because the way that these programs work is they've set prices for 10,000 different procedures, and then they will pay healthcare providers based on how many procedures they perform. However, this incentivizes low-quality, recurring procedures rather than actually making the patient healthy. We're spending nearly $2 trillion a year, and yet we're getting systematically low-quality healthcare for the people that we're trying to help. Not only are we giving them low-quality healthcare, but hospitals are incentivized to view them as a captive market because there is no price competition. And beyond that, we should also be thinking about who exactly we're putting in these Medicare-Medicaid cohorts. When these programs were invented in the 1960s, there was an impression that senior citizens needed help from the government. But at least today, they are the wealthiest age cohort in all of America. The median wealth of a senior citizen in America is over $400,000. There's no reason that we should be universally subsidizing the healthcare of all these people who may be owning mansions and may be millionaires, and yet because they're over 65, are part of this program. My alternative, then, is to radically move government outside of the healthcare market and to replace Medicare and Medicaid with means-tested health spending vouchers. What this means is rather than having 10,000 different prices set by the government, rather than having multiple organizations passing money from the federal government to hospitals, we instead give each and every low-income, low-asset American, whether they're 65 or 7, a healthcare spending voucher that they can then use as they see fit. This will increase the amount of competition in the market and allow them to choose the procedures and providers that are actually going to improve their lives. On top of this, we can have a universal catastrophic health insurance. So if someone is hit with a single healthcare bill that is more than 10% of their income, it can be covered by the government. This program is very similar to what's used in Singapore and Switzerland, and these countries have some of the highest life expectancies in the world, as well as maintaining relatively low healthcare spending. If we were to follow through with this plan, we'd find that instead of spending around $1.9 trillion a year, we'd cut spending down to $600 billion a year while maintaining high quality of care. And with the $1 trillion we spend, with the $1 trillion we save every year, we could do things such as, for example, building a metro system in every city in America.
Thank you for the opening statement. Stephen?
For the format, am I just speaking back to everything, or what's
pressure on this.
Yeah, so the idea is to have about a 2 minute
rebuttal. Okay.
But if you want to go a couple seconds over.
Okay, gotcha. Oftentimes, when people speak about Medicare and Medicaid, people attack kind of American health insurance from a lot of different angles, and I find that some of these angles are very convincing until you start to dig into them, and then they become a little bit less convincing. So, for instance, we kind of want to tie life expectancy, for instance, into healthcare spending or healthcare funding in the United States, and then compare that to spending or life expectancy in other parts of the world. But in the United States, we have issues related to suicidality or violent crime or firearms, for instance, that also directly curb life expectancy, especially by killing some of our youngest people. Last I heard, under the age of from 18 and below, your most likely way of dying is due to firearm violence. I don't know if changing how we spend money on healthcare would necessarily cut into things like that. I'm not really convinced they would. So I'm not sure how much the life expectancy thing would be helped when we look at, you know, allocating resources differently in terms of healthcare. Same thing when it comes to like preventative medicine or preventative healthcare. One of the biggest things that pushes a lot of Americans into an unhealthy place in life, especially as they get older, is obesity. And that's another thing where I'm not fully convinced that simply moving some of our money around with how we spend in the United States on healthcare would actually do anything to alleviate the massive obesity stuff. When it comes to hospitals being incentivized to give, you know, bad health care or to do routine treatments, I think that it's kind of hard to speak about hospitals as being like a fully rational market where consumers can price chop and have a ton of different information available to them, typically because at the point of consumption of healthcare, a lot of the time we don't really have the luxury of making those choices for a variety of reasons. In an emergency situation, obviously you don't have time to make phone calls to different hospitals. There might not be any other hospitals around that offer what you in particular need. If a person has like a heart emergency or some kind of stroke, I doubt that somebody's going to be calling around to see who has the best stroke doctor or the best cardiologist or whatever. You're probably just going to whatever's closest. And then those types of specialists are in short supply in general. So I doubt that you have 10 different heart specialized hospitals even in your area, regardless. So I don't know if moving health insurance to a private market or getting rid of Medicare and Medicaid would do much to alleviate or would do much to help us shop for healthcare. It just doesn't seem like a very efficient market to shop in. I know that when we talk about old people and we talk about their wealth and we say, well, maybe these people should be able to spend more on healthcare, there's a whole other conversation. But I think for the United States, the most common way that we have our wealth, especially in old age, is tied up in our homes. And even if it was, on paper, good economic policy, which I'm not fully convinced it is, I think the idea of grandma or grandpa being forced to sell their house when they have a major operation is probably something that would be so catastrophically bad politically that that system would just be completely unbearable. I'm kind of a fan of like means testing in some ways. It's my inner free market, you know, libertarian, whatever guy. And I shouldn't say libertarian. I should say neoliberal is the one that they say. But the issue, when we talk about like means testing here, like we're talking about means testing people at different levels of healthcare and giving them a minimum spending voucher that they would be able to spend on healthcare and covering them in the event of like catastrophic events and making sure like at all points in their life they're like qualified for this coverage and it has to slope off so that when you gain more money, it doesn't all go away so you're not disincentivized to earn more money. I feel like at the end of the day, even if you're a fan of means testing because you think it'll save money, that whatever system we put in place there is going to be so absurdly complicated, you've either reinvented some form of Medicaid or Medicare, or it becomes more bureaucratic and less efficient than if we were to just do Medicaid or Medicare.
Thank you. I'd like to open it up for a back and forth debate. I invite both speakers to keep arguments and answers under about a minute or so, so that we can have a productive series of a productive conversation.
Sure. Can I ask the first question? So this is the big thing that I have, okay? So again, I'm a big free markets guy. I love fighting with the left. It's very fun for me. That being said, when it comes to healthcare, I'm a big fan of don't reinvent the wheel. I look at every other healthcare system across the world. Who has, in a real country, in a large country, so no, Singapore doesn't count, in a full country with more than 5 million people, okay? Who has a healthcare system that you think the United States should more, I guess, try to copy? Because I feel like everybody has these same types of like, multi-payer or public option or single-payer systems, yeah?
Yeah, it's a good question. I mean, I would also point out that Switzerland is a country that uses, not only do they have health vouchers and catastrophic insurance, they were actually the primary model for Obamacare, specifically for the idea of having a mandatory, mandating that people buy some form of health insurance so as to bring down the total lower cost. And obviously, I know back in like the 2012, this was like a socialist idea, but I mean, you know, I actually think it's kind of a good idea. I think that being more thoughtful about how we're deploying you know, government intervention in the market can lead to some major gains. I think Switzerland's a great example. I think Germany also has a similar example where they really work with their kind of economic sort of trade unions in making sure that people have access to health insurance. But what I find unique about those, and that's, you know, not what we see with Medicare, not what we see with the NHS, is that in both those cases, it's still private insurance companies that are doing like all the work, and it's not the government setting up its own insurance system, which is my main issue.
In the United States, we still have basically most of it is private insurance anyway, though, right? Like even for Medicare, you've got like these Medicare Part B plans that are provided with a lot of regulation, but by private insurance nonetheless. Why do you think that just moving the government out of it completely is going to magically, I guess, like boost? I don't even know what it's boosting. Like where, because I feel like all the issues that you have relating to people making choices about healthcare consumption, there's still going to be that insurance wall that's going to block them off from any shopping for like hospitals or medical procedures anyway, no?
Yeah, I think the question of this like lack of information, like an inefficient market is probably, I would say, can be broken into three categories that you also addressed in some of your responses earlier. One is the question of price transparency. I agree it's a big problem right now that, you know, if I need to get some blood transfusion, I don't know what it's going to cost me until 2 weeks after the fact. So I actually think that, you know, in 2020, there was a regulation promulgated forcing, in fact, all hospitals to display their prices online. The execution kind of failed on that. But I do think that these sorts of regulations are going to be really helpful for maintaining a more efficient market. That's point one. Point two, beyond transparency, is about the you mentioned like the urgency, right? Like very inelastic demand. Like if I just got shot, I'm not gonna, you know, check on Google like what's the cheapest hospital. I think this is true for catastrophic health procedures, but I would actually say the vast majority of spending is discretionary. People spend on things like diabetes treatment, people spend on things like dialysis. And these are long-term treatments where you do have the ability to choose where you're gonna put your money. And that gets to my final point, which like why are we gonna see price benefits even beyond Part B? Because even with Part B, it is a third party, someone working in the government following a set of regulations, who is trying to balance quality and price and access and location, everything. And I generally find that, you know, individual spenders, people who are empowered to make their own decisions, are going to make a better and more cost-effective decision than having a third party do it. And so I'd say even Medicare Part B is still having a third party choose what private health insurance a patient is going to be interacting with.
When you say that patients would be able to make better choices, so not to come down on the average American citizen, but like the average person in general, I feel like a lot of these choices are very difficult for an ordinary person to navigate. Like if somebody were to ask, you know, a person like, do you want this medication or this one? And this has this risks and this benefits, like even choosing to weigh, you know, which risks and benefits, like I imagine these are still conversations you're going to have with your doctor to some extent. I imagine that they probably do their research and everything else. What do you think is the big, what do you think changes if Medicare and Medicaid disappear that isn't already like at play right now?
Yeah, I... Yeah, so I agree. I don't want, you know, individual Americans choosing like what sort of medicine to use or exactly how to like go into the body to do the surgery. That would be really bad. But I think that, you know, we do have markets for other complicated things, such as, okay, what computer am I going to buy? What car am I going to buy? How am I going to get these things fixed? And the way that people compete on that is not by maybe some people, but most people don't go into the deep technical knowledge. Rather, they use the reputation of the provider. Right, saying that, okay, you know, these doctors are highly rated, these doctors are, you know, have good word of mouth for my friends, etc. And while it's not a perfect system, I would say it's better than the status quo, where right now, because Medicare and Medicaid reimburse at lower rates than private insurance, people on these programs systematically get lower quality providers or providers who are not giving them the time of day. So I think putting them in the general market will still allow for more like reputational competition or word of mouth competition.
I would say it's problematic to compare it to like repair stuff, because I feel like these are places that have the worst reputations already. The idea of going to like a car repair shop and getting scammed by somebody who is charging you for lighter fluid or, you know, or headlight fluid or whatever, stuff like this. I guess my big question would be, so broadly speaking, the first question I asked is, it seems like every country has a way of doing things where the government has to have some big intervention in order to provide healthcare for the entire population in a way that is ideally the most efficient, right? Where everybody's not waiting until the last minute to get healthcare treatment, where everybody can afford healthcare to some extent. You don't want your poor citizens to just completely be locked out of all diabetic treatment or all kind of chronic cost of care stuff. If it was possible to set up a system right now in the United States where private care was better, what do you think are the big roadblocks, or why hasn't anybody done it yet? Or where is the money? Like, right now, we're spending so much money on this healthcare system right now. I imagine you're saying that the next one is going to provide better results for less money. Where's that less money? Where's that money coming from? What's absorbing all the money right now that you think is going to be taken care of? Yeah, and why hasn't a private one popped up yet?
See, the amazing thing about these sort of government programs is that once they come into existence, they create their own constituency of hundreds of thousands, if not millions of people whose jobs directly benefit on this program existing. And I think you'd find that many hospitals and healthcare providers, they know that a Medicare, Medicaid patient is gonna have, they're not gonna leave because they don't really have many options. They're gonna get regular checks from the government. They're not really gonna be judged on their day-to-day performance because it's someone else far away. So I frankly say that a lot of people in the healthcare industry benefit from this arrangement. And, they're the people who are out there going to Congress, with all these briefs. Most people don't really talk about abolishing Medicare, Medicaid, because it's one of those problems where, it's someone else's problem. So I would say, it's these sorts of entrenchment factors that are the reason we haven't gone to this point.
Okay, that sounds very faith-based to me. I'm not sure if I believe that there would be a ton of savings to be found there. What do you do with people with, chronic conditions? So let's say somebody has diabetes. They're going to be on some expensive, they need some expensive regular care. No insurance provider rationally would adopt this person under any policy unless the government was forcing them to. Would you still have a bunch of government forcing people to buy insurance and then forcing insurance companies to take on any patient regardless of, pre-existing conditions or chronic conditions or anything like that?
Yeah, I think the best path forward for this situation is to use a combination of the Obamacare mandate, which does, want everyone to be in insurance pools. But then second, by having these vouchers targeted towards people, if they show they have this expensive pre-existing condition that is, very large relative to their income, I think it is a good idea to give them more government assistance in that case. And I still think that even with additions like this, right, the overall impact on healthcare spending will be much less than the status quo, where 40% of all healthcare spending comes from Medicare and Medicaid.
And you're not worried about that same entrenchment occurring with the voucher system that it already does with Medicare and Medicaid, according to you? Why wouldn't there be all these healthcare systems that pop up to extract, these social rents from people, knowing that they're going to come in with their means-tested voucher and just, ripping those people off?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I'm not saying it's going to be a totally perfect system, but there'll still be much more fluidity and much more movement amongst people who can go to different providers based on the quality that they're receiving. And so I think that the social cost will be much reduced.
I'm sympathetic towards a lot of, open market healthcare issues. I think that there are some things that markets can't provide for utility companies, things we have to duplicate infrastructure, things that have high cost to entry, certain inelastic goods, et cetera, et cetera. I guess kind of back to the first question, I kind of asked it again. When I look at countries around the world, I wish that there were larger countries that adopted kind of these private model systems, because I just don't see them ever being adopted at scale. I do know that there are countries, Germany, I think, has a multi-payer system where you can buy private insurance on top of your socially mandated, healthcare coverage. But I don't see anything working in a fully private sense. I feel like we kind of need that social safety net for all the factors that I brought up earlier. That's my position on it.
I would like to thank both debaters for an engaging debate.
Thank you, Hassan. We'll move now into round two. The topic is Corporate Greed Kills Abundance. Debating this round will be with Stephen is Sherry Huang. Sherry will be arguing that corporate greed undermines any promise of liberal abundance. Stephen will be pushing back on this claim. Sherry, please begin when you're ready.
Likewise, thank you for coming to Yale and having this wonderful discussion with us. I know you just said you're a big open markets guy and you love arguing with the left. And so my argument is that corporate greed kills abundance liberalism through specifically intentionally protecting scarcity. A couple examples. The first one I'd like to talk about is the pharmaceutical industry, which abuses patents to spike prices without innovating by using Me Too drugs, which if you guys aren't familiar, that's just drugs that are very, very similar to previously innovated drugs. And they do this, or they get FDA approved through lobbying the FDA, and they also buy out innovation by buying out smaller competitors, which not only wastes innovation, but also preserves monopolies and hikes prices. And that's why in the status quo, even with some regulations from the government, Americans still pay three times as much for prescription drugs than our foreign counterparts. And further deregulation through abundance liberalism would only exacerbate the issue. And it's not just the pharmaceutical industry. For example, there's general lobbying in a lot of sectors, like public transit, healthcare, oil, and surveillance companies specifically just gave $40 million to both political candidates from both parties during the 2020 electoral cycle that overall prevents government action from regulating them. And even if on the surface right now they look like they're trying to improve, for example, through climate-friendly action, welfare support, et cetera, it's what a writer, Lucia Holsether, calls capitalist humanitarianism, which is kind of a litany of tactics, one of which is companies like upcharging for more ethical goods, for example, like renewables, because they're perceived as more valuable, even if they're now cheaper to manufacture. And specifically on the environment, companies are focused on resource extraction rather than preservation, because preservation's not profitable. And even if it's using renewables like battery, corporations will always be focused on garnering more production and thus market power rather than developing energy to actually support the people, which is why rare earth mineral mining right now similarly degrades the environment a lot. So instead, I think we should adopt a more people-centric regulatory framework, including limits on campaign spending and donations to limit lobbying, and to prevent the most elite candidates from having a large advantage through this large amount of lobbying and money that's garnered through campaigns. And yeah, that's my argument.
Thank you. Stephen?
So when it comes to talking about like scarcity or corporations or government involvement in markets, the thing that I like to focus on the most is that like there's this foundational truth that everybody tries to run away from at different parts in an argument, and that's such that markets are real. So when I say markets are real, what I mean is that there are times when I think even if the government needs to intervene, we have to understand that if the government intervenes in some way, there are going to be all of these extra effects that we have to be aware of, and we can't just kind of like hope those effects away. Sometimes I feel like when people are identifying different players in markets, people on the left will come down on corporations and say that they're evil and greedy, and people on the right will, build up corporations and say, well, actually, they're altruistic and they're trying to make life better for all of us. But I think that people just forget that different players in the market have different jobs. So a corporation's job is just to make money at the end of the day, and it's going to make money in whatever way they are capable of doing so. So if a corporation can make money at like revolutionizing a product and making something better for us, then they'll do it, and that'll be better for all of society. If a corporation can make money by dumping all of their toxic waste in a river that might feed into a town of 10,000 people that can never hold them legally accountable, then they'll dump the toxic waste because it'll return more value to shareholders. I think that the important thing when it comes to talking about abundance is recognizing like what are the different players in a market, like what can they bring to the market, what are they able to do to the market, and what are their incentives, and then what do we expect them to do in the market. I would never expect a firm to maximize for environmental good unless there was a huge government restriction or a huge government penalty on doing environmental damage. So for systems like cap and trade, or for systems that tax you based on, like how much pollution you emit. I think that these are good systems because it encourages companies to try to incentivize or find ways to produce things that have less environmental damage, because then they can make more money, and their way of returning profit to shareholders is in a way that also aligns with the interests of the public, at large, external of that particular market. So they're not like causing environmental damage just because they want to make a cheaper shoe or something. I do agree that there are things in the United States, and I think that market people have a difficult time admitting this, where only the government can really provide good services. The idea that people are obsessed with things like Waymos or obsessed with Elon Musk's 450th convoluted idea for how to reinvent something that would really just be like a subway system or like basic public transit, I think is really dumb. I think that there are some things that the government can do well, and when it comes to those things, we just need to let them do it well. For the two abundance authors, I think that was their big, for Klein and Thompson, that was their big argument that like if the government can do it, like let them do it and tear down all the roadblocks, because there's no reason. In the United States, we have so much regulatory framework, even around the government doing stuff. But in places where free markets can provide solutions, I think that the markets need to provide the solutions, and we can't pretend that the government's going to solve our way out of those problems, mainly because the people that claim that we can solve certain problems using the government are problems that just have never been solved by government. I think housing is a big one that comes up a lot, where we have all of these different like ideas around like rent control or public housing or whatever else, and the reality is it's a very simple math problem of there are X amount of houses available and X plus N amount of people want to live here, and that's just never going to be workable no matter what you do from a government policy standpoint.
Yeah, cool. So on the topic of housing, I want to talk about New York City because that's like a hot topic recently. But there's like, in my mind, there's like infinite people who want to live in New York City, right? Because of the economic opportunities, the social opportunities, et cetera. And the right now, the issue with New York housing that we have is that there's more demand than there is supply, which means that these like landowners and these apartment, you know, I forgot the word for it. Sorry. But like landowners, they're able to hike prices as high as they want because there will always be people who will buy the houses at those super high prices, which just like prices every single like lower income working class person out of those houses. So even if like, sure, it upsets the market, but and there creates like, you know, even more demand for an already limited market, at least in that demand, poor or like working class people are similarly competitive as like super elite people.
So I don't necessarily disagree with you there. This is a really hard question because nobody really wants to address it on either side. But the question then is like, who deserves to live in a particular area? So one topic that comes up a lot is like rent control. When we talk about rent control doesn't benefit the rich. It doesn't benefit the poor. The rent control benefits whoever's there right now. And that's it. And generally, you can see who's benefited by rent control because they live in a rent controlled unit. You don't see the people that are hurt by rent control because they're people that could never move into the city otherwise because those units aren't available or that it's not being demolished and more stuff is being built because of the restrictions or regulations around that particular unit. I think a question that's like very difficult that people at some point have to be able to grapple with is if you have, you know, 5,000 units available in some area and the prices on those units are high because everybody wants to live there, who's to say, you know, well, 1,000 of these should be dedicated to, you know, low-income people versus high-income people. Like, if you want to save up more money and live in some area, is it more fair that a person who won a lottery, you know, got a dedicated housing unit and then you didn't, even if you had more money to pay for it? Like, I don't know why. Do you think that that's necessarily more fair that to do it via lottery versus income or?
Well, I do, because like the whole point of lottery systems is that it's more fair, right? And also, it is like it gives everyone an equal chance and equal opportunity. And I think a lot of people who are wealthier, especially in the United States, get that either from like generational wealth or from like a lot of billionaires, I personally think, like exploit workers a lot. And a lot of, you know, lower income people aren't lower income because they don't work hard. It's because of, you know, structural disadvantages that they've had to face, whether it's because of generational wealth or race, etc. And I think being able to give those a greater opportunity, it also like goes back to the idea of like affirmative action, right? Giving those people like a comparatively more opportunity will only even the playing field rather than, you know, giving them a larger opportunity, if that makes sense.
So I don't necessarily disagree in theory. I just think in practice, like rent control, you already have to be there to have the unit. Like, I don't think that, like, if there were minorities or disadvantaged people for whatever reason that didn't have generational wealth or whatever else that wanted to move into New York City, it's not like they could magically, you know, swoop in and grab one of these rent controlled units. I don't want to get stuck too much on housing, although I know we have limited time, just because I feel like for housing that the biggest issue you run into is, I guess actually it ties into the argument that I'm having related to, you know, firms are incentivized to do what firms do, unions do what unions do, you know, buyers do what buyers do. I think the issue is that when it comes to housing, your most stringent voter block are going to be your people that have the biggest stake in housing, and their stake is to keep housing as unaffordable and as exclusive as possible, because anything that you do to make housing more available or affordable is going to necessarily lower the rents or lower the value of the homes of the people that currently live there. So I think the NIMBYism is a big issue where people don't want expansion of housing because it'll threaten their, you know, the biggest asset that they own for their family. I think that's one of the issues where this would be a good government thing. Well, though they already kind of restrict the housing supply by doing zoning, where the only solution for this is just zone more houses and to have developers come in and build. But again, housing is a special thing because it's like a very restrictive market. When it comes to things like healthcare, I get this argument a lot that people will talk about, you know, the patent abuse on drugs and everything. And I guess I'm sure there are examples of that. But one of the issues that I have when people bring this up is like insulin is the most talked about drug when people talk about these types of things, about how they'll make a small tweak and then they'll claim that this insulin is better, even though insulin was made, you know, off patent, how, you know, 100 years ago, whatever, the first guy to, you know, suck it out of a pig, you know, decided this is going to be insulin that everybody can use. That insulin is still available. You can buy that insulin, I think, at Walmart. You can buy it cheaply. You can buy it freely. But the problem is that insulin sucks. And the insulin that our pharmaceutical companies make today is like infinitely better than just the pig-derived insulin or whatever. Like the synthetics that we have today, you know, it's long-lasting, it's slow-release, it helps to moderate your blood sugar more. It does a way better job at, you know, the two injections you get per day where you have a big crash and then your blood sugar goes high. So I feel like even when it comes to like patent abuse or pharmaceuticals, like there are areas that these companies are still innovating in. But yeah, I don't want to take up all your time. Go, yeah.
Yeah, on the topic of insulin specifically, you yourself say that, like, the super old insulin from, like, however many decades ago is not great for your body, or at least not as great as the newly innovated insulin. But the issue is, you yourself also say that the newly innovated insulin is also a lot more expensive than the super cheap one from Walmart. So my question would be, like, do lower income people only deserve, like, the bad insulin because that's the only thing they can afford?
No, I mean, well, unlike the earlier guy, I don't think we should have only private healthcare. I just think it's important to recognize, like, we just can't have everything. Like, sometimes people want everything to where they want, like, the newest stuff that anybody in the United States could manufacture, but then they also want it to be freely available to everybody, and they want to be the cost to be low as well. And, I mean, like, all of you have access to Fidelity or Vanguard. Like, you can open a trader account, and you can go and look at big pharmaceutical stocks. These companies don't really make more money than any other company in our system, and they're notoriously unreliable as well, because sometimes they live or die based off of a single patent, you know? There were a lot of companies that were competing against each other that have the COVID vaccine, for instance. So I think that, when it comes to, we need to have basic social safety nets for people, because you just, for people to be really wealthy in a country, your lower class, your working class, your bottom class, your lower middle class, whatever you want to call them, they have to have access to some, like, floor of goods and services. Otherwise, it just doesn't feel good to live in a place where, you know, you're stepping over bodies to get to work. Like, I agree that there should be some minimum level of stuff available, for sure. I just sometimes, like, I guess the question I'm curious, this isn't necessarily a fairest question, but, like, when you think of the difference between a person living on minimum wage versus, a middle-class person, like, what do you think the difference in their lifestyle should be? Like, if you work 40 hours a week on a minimum wage, should this person be able to afford, like, a single-room house and a car and internet and everything else? Or, like, what do you think a person that just lives on, like, 40 hours a week minimum wage should be able to buy?
I actually don't think one person living off of, especially if this one person has, like, a dependencies, like, for example, children, would be able to buy everything that they need to thrive. Maybe survive, but I don't think they could thrive off of the minimum wage, especially because I'm from Texas and our minimum wage is, like, $7.50, which is definitely not enough to buy housing in Texas, to buy, like, groceries, especially healthy groceries, but that's another argument. And just, like, everything they need to support their child in terms of education, childcare, etc. And this is also kind of another argument, but I also think there's a huge disparity between the living wage, or the minimum wage that we have legally right now, and the actual living wage, which is estimated to be around $15 for Texas, which is two times the minimum wage. And a lot of these times, this disparity comes in the form of being unable to, for example, like, afford healthcare, especially in rural areas where it takes a lot of, you know, gas money, oil money to get to the hospitals in the first place. And a lot of people, you know, die because they don't go get healthcare. And I think that's also, like, a really big issue. And, you know, that also is in part because of a shortage in medical workers, but I also think it's because people just simply can't afford or get access to life-saving medicines.
I'm curious, so 5 minutes. So for the topic of this thing, it was corporate greed kills abundance. What do you think are, like, a couple big policies? You mentioned, like, a people-centric framework. What do you think are a couple big policies that are both advantageous to people in general, but is, like, contrary to what, I guess, like, abundance liberals advocate for?
Yeah, so for example, I think there should be a very strict limit on campaign spending and campaign donations, because right now the reason why there's so much lobbying in the government is because these political candidates get most of their money for their campaigns to win and be in government from corporations. And thus that also allows, like, the candidate with the most connections, the most elite candidate, to win that position. And then when they're in office, they have no choice but to, you know, follow corporations and whatever they say. And putting that strict limit will not only level the playing field in terms of political elections, but also, you know, prevent corporate lobbying.
So I'm not going to go all into Citizens United, because there are good arguments on both sides of that, as upset as that makes people. That being said, I think I'm probably on the side of, like, some kind of way to eliminate super PACs is probably a good idea, if for no other reason, just because it looks really bad. But I feel like most abundance liberals wouldn't necessarily disagree there. I feel like maybe I should have asked for the question. When you say abundance liberalism, are you talking about, like, the Klein and Thompson book with, like, the abundance liberals and everything?
Yeah. I think on that point, I'm mostly talking about how, like, innovation is kind of impossible. Or you also touched upon this, but we kind of lost the plot. But I think innovation is kind of impossible with the corporate system we have today, because, like I talked about before, pharmaceutical companies just make me-too drugs that are maybe marginally more innovative and marginally better, but spread out across, like, years when it really could be a lot faster. innovation, usually it's these smaller companies that innovate because that's the only way they can compete. But a lot of the times, before they can fully innovate, these large corporations just come in and buy out that smaller organization, that smaller corporation, so that they can maintain their monopoly.
Gotcha. Okay, so the only reason I bring this up is because I feel like generally abundance liberals are probably also going to be like in favor of some kind of restriction on spending from lobbyists, because I think that most people consider this kind of like rent-seeking behavior. You're basically spending money towards some kind of like government policy or regulation that avoids you spending money to innovate or provide a better product or service. The last thing that you brought up, I'm a bad person to argue for that, because actually I think that the culture of creating a company just to sell it to another company, I actually think is absolute cancer, and I actually don't like the amount of vertical and horizontal integration that seems to be built into a lot of our technology sector. That if you talk to anybody in San Francisco, like the goal, the dream is to be bought by, to acquired by Amazon or Google or whatever else, and I actually think there do need to be way more restrictions on that. I don't know how Facebook can own, I think, like WhatsApp, you know, and Instagram and Facebook and Messenger and everything else, so... I wouldn't necessarily disagree there. I don't know if a lot of abundance liberals would necessarily disagree on that either, but I guess you'd have to ask them on that. Yeah, is there a third? Any other thing? I'm trying to think of a.
Well, I was just talking about in terms of innovation, like a bunch of abundance liberals think that deregulation is the best way to achieve innovation, which I think is totally untrue, because deregulation will only allow companies to again create Me Too drugs, for example, and spike prices. And I think, well, right now we're not seeing, you know, a whole lot of innovation. So either way, it's like kind of, you know, try or die.
I mean, I think I disagree. You don't think we see any innovation in the American healthcare system at all, or?
I think we see very little as to what we could accomplish. Like the COVID vaccine came out really, really fast. And that's because there were a bunch of government incentives created for these companies. The issue is there's not government incentives for like any other drug.
I think there are. We have like the rare drugs program or whatever. There's a name for this. But for rare diseases, the government offers a bounty. There's also, I think like my guess would be probably within like 15 to 20 years, I think we'll have drugs for Alzheimer's disease that will be on the market. Like we're very, very, very close to kind of cracking the egg on that. I don't know if that's a saying or not, but I feel like there is innovation there. Sometimes it's hard to see, especially right now. It used to be that liberals were the ones that kind of fought against the companies, and then conservatives would highlight the successes of the companies. But because Trump has made everybody lose their minds right now, conservatives aren't like highlighting any successful things that any corporations have done. So like nobody is speaking out for the poor billionaires and the poor huge corporations. I do agree that we do need a better regulatory environment. One of the biggest arguments, to echo my queen Nancy Pelosi, who said that we need a Pelosi is a queen, okay? In this house, we don't disrespect Pelosi. Not while I'm here, okay? But Pelosi said we need a strong conservative party, and I think part of the reason why we need a strong conservative Republican party is so that we can bring back these like regulatory questions, because right now we really don't have any approach to regulation. The left wants to regulate for whatever the agenda is, and Trump wants to deregulate for whatever he can get bribes on or invest personally in to enrich himself and his family. So we don't have that good conversation anymore. So yeah. I think that, largely speaking, I would say abundance liberalism is about trying to find things that the market can do well and then rewarding them for that. And then when they can't do it well, get out of the way of the government doing it. I think we like half agree on some of this and half agree on disagree on other things. But go ahead.
Yeah. Kind of. I just think that there's not much that the market can do well except make money. And I don't think making money, or at least corporations making a bunch of money, like billions of dollars, is necessarily a good thing for also a litany of other factors. I think my overall argument is just that corporations can't do much well, and thus we have to rely on a non-corporate led government, which also doesn't exist right now, actually. But that's, I think, where I mostly disagree with abundance liberals. But
thank you. Let's give the debaters a round of applause.
For round three, we turn to a more personal and media-focused question. The topic is, Destiny's rhetoric inflames the political climate. On this round, we have Hannah Owens, the president of Yale Effective Altruism and the member of the Yale Debate Association. Hannah will be arguing that Stephen's style of rhetoric makes the political climate much more polarized. Stephen, of course, will have a chance to defend and respond to your approach. Hannah, you can start us off.
So Destiny, you have made statements such as, conservatives need to be afraid of getting killed when they go to their events so that they turn down the temperature. You repeatedly refused to condemn the murder of Charlie Kirk. I won't woo over that. And after his murder, you tweeted making fun of his death, saying, I heard when he died, he fed an entire village of vampires because so much blood came out of his neck. Following the assassination attempt on Donald Trump, which killed one of his supporters, you said that you have zero sympathy for anything that happens to him or to anyone who supports him. You have also said that your only regret is that Trump's assassin didn't spend enough time practicing first. So there are a couple of things wrong with this. First, it's hypocritical. You cannot claim that Trump is a threat to democracy while simultaneously calling for political assassinations, which are a threat to democracy. You've also criticized left-wing figures for doing the same thing, like when the streamer Hassan tweeted a picture of a makeshift gun at Senator Tom Cotton. Second, it's immoral. As a public live streamer with millions of viewers, you make it more likely that someone in your audience will take matters into their own hands and start killing off conservatives, especially as a study by the Center for Strategic and International Studies found that left-wing political violence now outnumbers right-wing political violence. Third, it's bad for the country. Your rhetoric amplifies the extreme left and right. When conservative influencers like Matt Walsh say that the left wants me dead, your statements provide proof to that claim. There's a reason why extreme left-wingers like Hassan retweeted your statements about Trump's assassination. Political polarization destroys politics at the state and national levels when parties are unwilling to work together, and the Journal of Democracy finds a clear link between political polarization and political violence. And fourth, I think it's bad for you personally. You could be much more influential than you are right now if you didn't make extreme and hateful statements like these. You have a history of doing this that exceeds Republican behavior. You were deplatformed from Twitch for inciting violence during the BLM riots, and a mayoral candidate with whom you campaigned with had to cut ties with you for your hateful rhetoric. And since your goal is to help Democrats, I'd say that your rhetoric harms the movement that you claim to support. Ultimately, you are partially responsible for the extreme and divisive political climate that you critique. Your rhetoric inflames the American political climate, and I think that you have a net negative impact on the political space.
Jeez. Okay, so for my response to this, this is something that I've been stressing to people. There are two things that people see, and there's a third thing that people don't see. When it comes time to be civil in a conversation, both sides have to agree to that. One side can't agree and the other side not agree, and one side can't force agreement on that. And this is a thing that conservatives have been relying on liberals not understanding for decades. When one person, you know, comes into an area to start a fight with another person, that other person fighting back is not being hypocritical, is not being immoral, and is certainly not engaging in the same action as the person who came in to start the fight. So when it comes to speaking about, say, you know, you talk about how I never condemned the murder of Charlie Kirk, or I never said that the murder of Charlie Kirk is bad. It's actually not true. On that Piers episode where I was fighting with all the conservatives about it, I think twice on that show I said, yeah, nobody should be getting killed for political violence in the United States, but the right will not say this. And that is an unacceptable world where one side of this country has continuously, over and over again, disavowed political violence. I'm talking about, like, the political leaders. I'm talking about the Joe Bidens, the Barack Obamas. I'm talking about the differences when the assassination attempt was made against Donald Trump. Joe Biden gave a speech. He didn't blame either side. He said that everybody just needed to bring things down. He didn't mention that the shooter was Republican. He didn't blame Trump for his rhetoric. When Donald Trump was supposedly being hunted by Iran, Biden increased his Secret Service personnel, even though he had no obligation to. Meanwhile, Donald Trump stripped Secret Service protections from Kamala Harris and other Democrats as soon as he was in office, because he, you know, I won't say what his motivations were. I don't even know if he knows what his motivations are sometimes. And Donald Trump continues to do one-sided attacks against only one section of the country when it comes to calling for people to stop being violent. He went on Fox and Friends a day or two after Charlie Kirk was dead, and he said that when the left wing does violence, it's because they're evil. When the right wing does violence, it's just because they're just tired of the left wing doing it. When Biden was running for president, he had to disavow all the violence of the BLM protests. When Donald Trump ran for president the second and third time, he did it with the promise of pardoning every single January 6ther and every single person around him that was engaged in seditious conspiracy or a number of other crimes that were doing it to further Trump's interests. And he followed through with all of those pardons. When it comes to violent rhetoric, I'll make a lot of jokes. Now, conservatives supposedly make a lot of jokes. They said, I remember when Elon bought X that comedy was legal again. Apparently it's not, because I catch a lot of heat for some of my tweets, but they have no problem when it comes time to making jokes about Paul Pelosi, when he was almost beat to death by a guy in his house with a hammer, only because the cops showed up, the guy didn't get to go through with it. They have no problem making jokes or conspiracy theories about different shooters. Donald Trump didn't even acknowledge the death of the two Minnesotan lawmakers, or the one Minnesota lawmaker and her husband, and the other one that was attempted to be killed. When he was asked about this in the White House, he said, who? He didn't even remember it. This environment is not equal. So all this is said, and the most common response to me is basically, well, aren't you just making it worse? So I don't think that standing there and allowing yourself to have the most unbelievably inflammatory, hateful, disgusting, threatening remarks made at you as a side over and over and over again by one side and remaining quiet, I don't think that there is any virtue in that. I think insofar as you allow yourself to be ran over and destroyed by one side that has absolutely no limitations on how they conduct themselves, I just don't see what the virtue is in that. I've heard people online who have said things like, I was going to make this joke about this particular thing, but I know if I say this, Destiny's going to come at me and make this comment about it, so I'm not going to say anything about it. I think it's good that if you're a conservative and you read something that I say and that really, really pisses you off, really gets the snowflake twinkling or whatever, if that happens, good. I think you should feel upset. And maybe, just maybe, the next time Trump makes an unhinged tweet or truth, maybe a conservative stops and thinks, maybe it's not okay to just support these statements as trolls or memes or epic jokes. And maybe if I'm trying to hold a YouTuber I'm watching online more accountable for his speech than I am the president of the United States, maybe there's something that's deeply wrong and flawed with that system that the conservatives could step back and take a look at.
I respond. Okay, so what I'm not calling for is for you or for Democrats at large to remain quiet, right? What I think I'm clearly calling for you is to not do the same thing that you're critiquing conservatives and Republicans for doing. If you think that's bad when Trump says inflammatory rhetoric, or if a conservative calls for a Democrat to be killed, you can no longer criticize that practice when you then turn around and say, I actually want the conservatives to be being killed, and I want Trump to be the one who's getting killed.
You recognize that my position is not the same as them, though, right? That when they say it's funny and hilarious when the left gets killed and we're going to never recognize our side, that when I say, oh, okay, well, I'm going to copy the same stuff you do until you're willing to mutually accept that we stop, that these positions aren't the same, because they're never willing to stop, right?
Okay, so do you think that that's what's going to happen? You think that you going out there and saying conservatives need to be killed is going to lead to the conservatives saying, oh yeah, I really want to compromise with this person.
Well, so
I want to work together with the Democratic Party.
So now. I've never said that conservatives need to be killed. Okay, I've never said that.
Wait, so you said specifically that they need to be afraid of getting killed so that they turn down the temperature. But how is someone afraid of getting killed unless there's a threat to their life?
Sure. So if you saw more than just what Jesse Waters decided to show on his program on Fox, the entire conversation I'm having there is that when conservatives talk about violence in the United States, it's like a sexy, fun thing for them. And when liberals talk about it, it seems to be more of like a fearful thing, like, hey, we all need to stop. When I hear conservatives talk about violence in the United States, they seem excited for it. And I think there's no fear there. And I think they should be afraid. There was never a call for violence. And if you listen to anything I've said, like, I'm out here doing these events. Clearly, I don't want people getting shot out here because I'm probably going to be the first one to go if that actually happens. What I'm saying is that, like, you can't speak about these things. Like, there needs to be a healthy sense of fear that, like, if we continue to escalate, we're going to end up in like some civil war status, because conservatives act fearless when it comes to their rhetoric.
Yeah, but again, the same thing I would say, which I don't think was addressed, is do you think it's an effective strategy to get one side to negotiate with you to say that you're okay with them dying and it doesn't bother you if they get killed?
I think it's more effective than allowing them to do it, like, unimpugned, yeah.
Wouldn't it be more effective to say it's bad when they do it and that's how you can win voters to then get elected?
What? That didn't work last time, did it?
Oh, so you think just because Biden lost one election, that means that, MAGA Republicans rule the country and that Democrats have no chance of winning unless they become authoritarian themselves?
I think Democrats will win the next set of elections, but I think the fact that Trump won says something is deeply wrong with the American public right now and is deeply wrong with our discourse. If Kamala would have won all 7 swing states, it wouldn't have been as much of a landslide as it should have been in that election. The reality is that the president makes on a daily basis unhinged tweets that would dwarf the entirety of an ordinary Democratic Democratic president's tweet history combined. I can probably find something he's tweeted today or yesterday that he said that's worse than the totality of everything said in his entire administration for Obama, for Biden, for any of the Clintons. But Trump won his second election. So what happened there? Do you think that there's some virtue in Democrats just continuing to nod their heads and play along with Republicans and not act like all of the unhinged, insane rhetoric is coming from one side?
Yeah, again, I don't think that Democrats just need to go along with things. I think that criticizing one side, saying that they're engaging in some authoritarian practices or that they have very inflammatory rhetoric, is an effective tactic, especially when you're not doing the same thing. You lose your ability to criticize one side if you advocate for your political side of the aisle to do the very same thing to conservatives.
If my position isn't the same, how do you lose the ability to advocate for it? If somebody comes into a room screaming and I say, okay, well, I'm going to scream at the guys, I guess, until you stop, our positions aren't the same. That person is just screaming for no reason. My position is responsive to their position. That's how civility works. It's responsive to the other person's civility.
But what you're arguing is what, for instance, like Trump and conservatives are doing is a threat to democracy, right?
Yes.
And then you're saying, therefore, Democrats ought to do something which is also a threat to democracy.
Do you see how you lose the ability to criticize the first thing? That's like saying that, like, if the North goes to war against the South, they lose the ability to criticize the South for seceding from the Union. I disagree with that. If one side is going to conduct themselves in a violent manner, then the other side should be able to conduct themselves similarly.
So just to be clear, you think if Democrats get into office, they should do a January 6th style insurrection because conservatives already did it, right? So why not just let fire go, right?
If we do it, hopefully we don't fail like they did. Okay. I think that they should be. I think that there need to be severe repercussions for the current administration, mm-hmm. up to and including anything that related to the Department of Justice, related to investigations, related to what maybe creative interpretations of the law, like the conservatives have taken upon themselves to do. Yeah, because right now the pattern that we've set in the United States is that if you're a conservative, you can do basically whatever you want, and at the end of the day, the Democrats are going to show up to not only clean up your mess, but pretend you didn't do it, and then try to play along with you.
So then, what bothers me about that is Democrats really can't claim to be the party of democracy when you again make statements like this that, you know, it'd be fine and actually preferable for us to create an insurrection that would overthrow the democracy to instate forever democratic rule, right? So would you agree that you can no longer criticize Trump or conservatives for being a threat to democracy?
No, because my position is not the same as theirs. I'm willing to play democracy as long as they're willing to play democracy, but I'm not going to play democracy while they play
it. You won't defend democracy when another side is attacking it.
One side can't defend civility. It has to be two sides.
So that's just not true. I mean, the way that our system works right now, I guess you are not a fan of this, but when you have a democracy in place, you can win elections, and then you can, you know, get rid of all the bad policies and the things that you don't like from the other side. And what I think is that your rhetoric is making it less likely that Democrats are going to win elections. Because if you say the ideal Democratic Party is one which calls for violence against conservatives, or which says it's fine to, you know, disobey democratic norms so long as the other side is doing it, then voters don't see a distinction between you and Donald Trump.
The end goal is that when the other side sees, oh, well, if we do this thing, the other side's kind of responsive to it, so maybe we shouldn't do this thing because it leads to a really bad world. The issue that I have right now is the world that you're advocating for is one where Democrats just continue to, you know, say, okay, well, we're not going to engage in that because we want to have some, I guess, moral high ground, some imagined moral high ground, while Republicans engage in the most insane rhetoric possible and don't suffer any electoral losses for it. You keep saying that, like, well, if you engage in the same rhetoric that they do, you're going to lose voters. They won the last election. I don't know what that means. That's like the weaker side saying, if you do this thing that the other guy's doing, you're going to be weaker than he is, and he's already stronger than you.
But like you said, there's a difference between retaliation and starting a strategy to begin with. So if all the Democratic voters are voting for you because they believe in democracy and they believe in these norms, you take away the difference between you and Republicans when you start to engage in the same behavior that they are engaging with.
But there's still a difference. The difference is that the Democrats are willing to come back to the table and be adults if the Republicans are. And you say that, like, you're losing the voters. We already lost the voters. We lost the majority vote in the last election, and the first time in how long for the people that voted in the election. It doesn't seem like they care too much about it. It seems like they're more concerned with an executive that seems like it's championing the interests of the people with, you know, chants like lock her up, than they are about people caring about democratic norms. I think that it feels like the left isn't fighting for the American public when they just allow themselves to be steamrolled over and over and over again by a right whose rhetoric is getting increasingly unhinged.
Okay, so, like, just to clarify, you think it would be a good thing for Democrats electorally if they were to adopt the same rhetoric that Donald Trump or conservatives are currently using, like, on a mass scale?
Would it be better than just having them adopt it? Yes.
Okay, so you think it's better, though, than what the Democratic Party is doing currently, which is criticizing Trump and the conservatives for having that type of rhetoric?
Yes, because even an electoral win, I don't think is a real win. When it's 50-50 with like the most authoritarian guy ever, with a guy who's making truths and tweets about having his political opponents hanged, and then people are like, well, sometimes YouTubers are being kind of mean. Like, this world is not equivalent to me. It's not rational. It's not sane. Like, a bare win over a guy who's joking about running for a third term, and he's only joking about it because he's probably not even going to survive this term because he's so sick all the time. Sure. I don't think that's a huge political win for us.
Okay, but once again, I don't understand the criticism of Trump wanting Democrats to be hanged. If, you know, you think it's fine if a Democrat were to say that Republicans should be hanged, right?
If a guy was holding an explosive over here and I'm holding a weight that's going to drop and hit an explosive over here, if he blows me up, our positions are not the same. If he never blows his dynamite up, I'll never drop the weight and blow mine up. I just watched Terminator 2, so I remember the scene where the guy blew all the people up, right? But this is, you keep saying, Republicans keep making the same mistake, saying you guys have the same position, so now you can't criticize them anymore. My position is responsive to their position.
Sure, but do you think that once you pass that threshold, like, say once Democrats have done their own January 6th and we have no democracy, you really think you can get back to the system that we had beforehand? That there's an effective way to de-escalate the system after you have engaged in escalating it?
I think that whatever comes after, even if it's a war, is preferable to a system where the next person thinks that they can act like Donald Trump too and get away with it over and over again. Because right now, the Republicans, in their mind, they should run another candidate that's just like Trump, but worse, because they haven't even paid any electoral consequences for it.
Stephen, are you calling for a war when you say the next person is better?
No, I'm not calling for a war. What I would hope is that the president of the United States, I can't even believe that this is like a controversial statement. The president of the United States, if he was a moral human being, a man with integrity and honor, a leader of men, of people in the United States, should be able to say, all of us need to be less violent. That's like the most bare minimum decent statement in the world a person can make. But for some reason, the president can't make that statement, and conservatives are obsessed with criticizing the left anytime they say stuff that's even remotely approaching what the president of the United States is saying on a near daily basis, publicly, on social media, in 4K, like broadcasted to the whole internet, not even said with shame, like behind closed doors.
Okay, well, again, my response to this. So your response is, well, when Democrats do it, it's just in retaliation. When conservatives do it, they started it, right? A conservative would say the exact same thing. Someone like Donald Trump would say, the reason why I'm, you know, making inflammatory statements is because Democrats are engaging in political violence because they killed Charlie Kirk and because, you know, they want like Republicans to go to jail and they tried to indict me and all this stuff. So the escalation comes on both sides. You can make the argument from either side.
You can. If I stand at the bottom of a building and jump because I feel like I can't fly, and another guy says he can fly and he jumps off the building, there's a difference in truthfulness in these two statements. Republicans can pretend that the escalation has happened on both sides, but the record clearly demonstrates otherwise. Nobody was running around killing cops with a "I'm doing Joe Biden's orders" bumper sticker or whatever, or like, "I'm here for Biden. He ordered me to be here." That's not true. All of the unhinged stuff comes from Trump, from the conservatives. The conservatives, the only reason people even know about what people on the left say is because the conservatives will find people on the far left and amplify. The average left-leaning person doesn't want kitty litter boxes in schools, but Joe Rogan is out here saying that they're all over the place.
But I agree with that. I would say that a lot of the extreme violence that we see does come from the extreme left, from people like, you know, Hassan Piker advocate for violence, for instance. But as I said, you amplify those voices when you yourself support that violence. I don't think that the violence will be coming from these milquetoast liberals, but it will probably be coming from communists, from socialists, from authoritarians, from people who don't care about democracy fundamentally. And so by making violent statements, you're amplifying the voices of the people that you don't like, which is the extreme left and the extreme right.
Debaters.
Thank you, Hannah, and thank you, Stephen. For our fourth and final round, the topic shifts to ethics and personal behavior. You ought to be vegan. Debating this with Stephen is Cole Haynes, the president of Allied Students for Animal Protection. Cole will be arguing that we have a moral obligation to be vegan because animals are morally significant and killing them for food is wrong. Stephen will be challenging this conclusion. Cole, you have the floor.
Thank you so much, Aiden. Thank you to Yale Effective Altruism for putting this on. And thank you to Destiny. As someone who's not a formal debater myself, I really appreciate your ability to just come here on the spot, come up with this on the fly, as it were. So, in 2020, over the course of a few months, pork producers in Iowa Falls packed over 1 million pigs into barns. They then shut off the ventilation and pumped in 150-degree steam. Video shows pigs screaming, collapsing and writhing in pain for nearly 3 hours before the barn finally fell silent. Shortly after, a new batch of pigs were loaded in. This event was, by all plausible accounts, a holocaust. And yet few people know what happened, let alone that this kind of thing happens constantly. 80 billion land animals a year, that's 200 million every day, are raised on factory farms in some of the worst conditions imaginable. These facts make eating animal products, in my view, one of the worst things a person will do in their lives. My argument is very simple. First, I claim that it is deeply wrong to cause enormous amounts of pain, suffering, and death, even to animals, for comparatively trivial benefit. This is a modest claim. It doesn't require controversial views about animal rights or how much moral status animals have. It supports some of our most basic intuitions. For instance, most of us would agree that it would be seriously wrong to light a cat on fire for the sake of hearing its screams. My second claim is that in ordinary circumstances, when we buy or consume animal products, we cause massive amounts of suffering for trivial benefits. Consider some of the facts about factory farming as of 2025. Nearly all breeding pigs live in crates so small that they can't turn around. Piglets are castrated and mutilated without anesthetic. Many pigs arrive at slaughter with pneumonia. Transport alone kills hundreds of thousands. For broiler chickens, they're bred to grow so fast that most spend their lives in pain or are unable to walk. About 500,000 birds per year are boiled alive due to improper stunning methods in scalding tanks. Egg-laying hens live in cages smaller than a sheet of paper. Male chicks, about 7 billion a year, are killed on their first day of life because they're deemed unfit for the egg-laying hen industry. For years, scientific consensus has held that non-human animals experience pain and pleasure much like we do. As the 2012 Cambridge Declaration on Consciousness states, the weight of evidence indicates that humans are not unique in possessing the neurological substrates that generate consciousness. What makes torture morally bad is the intrinsic character of the experience, the way it feels from the inside, not the species or intelligence of the victim. A typical meat eater causes animals to spend about 132,000 extra days, that's roughly 364 years, on factory farms. Causing 364 years of torture is presumptively wrong. So the question is, do we have a sufficiently good reason for doing this? For most of us, we clearly don't. Animal products taste great. I will be the first person to admit this. And they're probably better than plant-based products. But our gustatory pleasure is clearly a bad justification for justifying torturing sentient beings. Especially for someone like Destiny, with the platform that you have, the stakes are even higher. If you convince just 3% of your average viewers to go vegan, you could help spare roughly 210,000 animals from some of the worst misery ever experienced by sentient beings. So my question to you, Destiny, is why aren't you vegan yet?
Okay, I think that there are two huge problems with veganism that I think vegans hand wave away, and they just kind of assume are one is that the thing doesn't matter, and then the second is that we just kind of take it for granted. So the first thing that I will say is it's strange to speak about moral ways to treat any class of things that will never themselves be able to conduct themselves in moral ways. I don't think that that's a request that we would ever make of any group of people or any individual, that you would treat, you know, some person or something or some entity that can never develop morality or any kind of moral systems on their own. So in a world with humans, you know, we talk about farming a pig as being this deeply unethical thing, but if you remove the human aspect from it, you put the pig in the wild and some tiger, I don't think pigs and tigers live together, but whatever fucking animal eats pigs, right? If this thing were to encounter the pig and eat it from the nuts up or whatever, because based on the videos I've seen on YouTube, it's a real crazy way that they hunt, that somehow that situation is like a morally preferable one to factory farming. The reality is that given a world where humans don't exist, where factory farming doesn't exist, all of the same type of animal suffering basically exists, you know, completely unstopped and unchecked by any animal, because nobody would even develop any moral system from these creatures until humans evolve that would ever check any of it. And so I don't know why there is a morally preferable world where animals exist that hunt other animals to the one that exists right now where humans factory farm animals, unless we just say animals themselves never develop the mind to have the agency to have any kind of moral culpability for any of the actions that they take. I'm not aware of any vegans saying that we should be charging animals that are carnivorous with crimes if they murder another animal, but for some reason we consider it unethical if a human consumes one for food. The second issue has to do with this concept of a mind like ours. I'm aware that mammals all possess like similar substrates, similar parts of the brain that do the things that our brain does, but I think it's pretty clear that none of these animals seem to have developed a mind like ours, such that there is no emergent culture, no emergent like real language capacity or communication skills or the ability to understand things in the past, present, and future, or in other areas at different parts in time. These are all like really sophisticated things that humans have developed, and I think also go into our understanding of things like pain and suffering as well. You can see an animal that gets hurt and it seems to have pain, and it might even develop some kind of like associative responses to stimuli in the environment, and it looks bad and it pulls at our heartstrings, and I definitely understand that. But I mean, I would hearken to the first thing in that for the moral argument, in the wild, these animals will never develop these moral systems. And then to the second thing, to say that we understand that their understanding of pain or suffering is similar to ours is a statement that I just don't think we can make. I don't know if we'll ever be able to make that statement. We can't even see consciousness really in other people. We just kind of assume it's there when the parts of the brain are communicating and they seem to have a conscious experience like ours. But to just automatically assume that animals that lack a whole bunch of other traits that humans have magically have that same capacity for pain or suffering, I just don't see where the argument would come from to support that statement.
So there's a lot to parse there. I guess the first thing I would ask is, I don't think you fully addressed the claim that I'm making, which is this intuition that we have that it would be wrong to torture a dog for the sake of hearing its screams or something like that. Most of us have this kind of intuition. My question is, how can we explain this intuition except for the principle that it's wrong to cause massive amounts of pain and suffering to beings, even animals, for the sake of relatively trivial benefits like, you know, the pleasure of hearing them scream? So how are you going to explain that principle without, you know?
Yeah, I would argue there's two senses of intuition pumping that's happening here. The first is that I think we heavily associate dogs with like man's best friend. Like, we've bred them to literally be domesticated animals that are friendly with humans. So the idea that you would be killing one, especially in a way where you're literally just doing it to, you know, have some kind of like weird pleasure, I think that hits against that. But I think people also get similar feelings, funnily enough. I watched this unfold in a Twitch stream once where a bunch of people were abusing this robot that was walking back and forth. They were kicking it was falling over, and people were like feeling kind of sad. I'm sure people watch Blade Runner 2049. They felt sad when the one like stick lady got stepped on or whatever, and even though she's a robot. But like, we have intuitions for these things, but I don't know if that like tells us anything about the nature of the animal itself, because if I were to look historically, it seems like hunting developed as a strong thing that was intuitively correct from basically all of human society. I'm not aware of any like huge civilizations. I don't know how common it is that, I guess, Indians are vegetarian or vegan, but for the most part, like every human civilization seems to have developed some form of like hunting or animal agriculture, and there wasn't this huge intuitive pushback against everybody doing it. Sorry, that was a long, yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, I'm still not sure you fully addressed. So you addressed some like reasons why we have these intuitions, but you didn't explain why these intuitions don't show that the action is wrong. That, you know, I guess what precisely is it that makes torturing a dog for the sake of hearing its screams, or, you know, kicking a robot or something, what makes those actions wrong?
Well, I feel like the thing that's wrong is it feels like anytime somebody is engaged in some kind of like needless destruction or is getting some kind of like pleasure out of seeing something else, you know, either break or be in some kind of pain, I think that as people, that just kind of throws up a red flag that it's unlikely that somebody's going to do that to, you know, an inanimate object or an animal, especially one that's bred to be like friendly with us, and not also do that same thing to other people. I think that's the thing that we just immediately kind of recoil from.
Okay, so I mean, to be clear, we put people who torture dogs in prison for many years. First, I think it's up to 7 years in some states. So you're saying the reason we do this is because it's indicative of some kind of cruel disposition that they might, you know, behave in other ways, in other wrong ways to other humans. Is that fair to say?
Well, if you're asking me where the law comes from, I mean, that's a complicated. But I guess
what would justify that putting people in prison for 7 years? I mean, maybe you think that we shouldn't put people in prison for 7 years who, you know, ruthlessly torture a dog for the sake of hearing their screams.
I mean, I would find more alignment with vegans there, and that I think it's strange to put people in prison for, you know, torturing animals like dogs, but animal agriculture is acceptable. But people obviously have a lot of issues with that who are meat eaters. So, but yeah, I mean, I would argue that it's probably because of like there's some kind of like sociopathic tendency or disposition there where you're just beating on a thing to feel good about yourself, whether it was an inanimate object or a dog or a cat or whatever. I think most people would view that in a very reprehensible light. But I don't think it speaks to like any kind of like intrinsic moral value or moral character from the creature itself.
Okay. And
otherwise, I would ask, well, like, why were so many different civilizations okay with developing hunting? Like, how were they able to get past this built-in? You say we have a deep moral intuition against animal cruelty. Why were so many people okay with hunting for animals?
Yeah, I mean, I have to imagine that's extremely divorced from the kind of suffering we inflict on animals today. Hunting for an animal is nothing like the way that we, you know, procure and consume animal products today. As I mentioned, you know, factory farming is one of the greatest sources of suffering on the planet if you think that animals are sentient. And I think that probably sufficiently explains the difference.
Do you think, I'm just curious, just real quick on that, would you be okay with animal agriculture if it was like, I forget what they call it, like torture-free farms?
Like humanely raised.
Yeah, whatever, like that kind of stuff. Is that an okay form of animal ag to you?
I think it would significantly reduce the badness of something like industrial animal agriculture. But I think there are like a lot of problems with this today. I mean, first of all, there's no such thing as a, you know, humanely raised animal. At least it's very hard to find them and like eat them multiple times a day. For one, if you purchase eggs, no matter if they're the pasture-raised eggs, you get them from your aunt's backyard or something. That it is almost 100% likely in the United States that this egg came from an egg-laying hen who was hatched in a hatchery where the male chicks are macerated, because they're just not, you know, you don't need them to lay eggs in the egg-laying hen industry. In practice, you know, there's no such thing as a humanely raised animal product, at least completely humanely raised. And then the second thing is just, I mean, when we think about the way that eating animal products affects our psychological attitudes towards beings that we think have some sort of moral value, it's clearly going to affect it negatively, right? I mean, there have been psychological studies that show people who, consume meat, humanely raised meat, you know, the most humanely raised they can find, tend to care less about the suffering of animals. They've done studies on this.
I'm sorry, could you repeat that? People that find the most humanely raised meat possible care less about the suffering of animals? Is that what you're saying?
Yeah. So I can't remember exactly how the study worked, but they found people who, you know, claim to consume only humanely raised meat and, you know, perform a few, like, psychological evaluations and find that, they're less likely to care about the suffering of animals. They're more careless about the suffering of animals, or callous to it.
Why do they eat more humanely raised products? I'm assuming they cost more, then, no? Isn't that kind of weird? Or what was the explanation for that?
Yeah, I'm not entirely sure.
Okay.
But besides that point, I think in practice, like I said, it's extremely hard to find humanely raised products in the real world. So you'd have to be like extremely diligent, almost as much as a vegan, in how your effort to reduce the suffering you cause with your animal product choices.
Theoretically, if you could do it, though.
Yeah, that was the original question.
Because my next question is going to be, it feels like then we're already closer in agreement on my end because you're putting them in some different category, because I don't think we would ever agree that there's like a morally okay way to raise and eat humans, right? So it seems like we're already putting animals in some different category, therefore saying it's okay in some ways to morally raise and consume them, no?
Again, I'm willing to concede certain facts about animals generating them having less moral status. I think that... there are just still so many problems with the current system that it's in practice, you know, it's not something that's a real concern. For instance, I mean, most of the animals that are killed in the United States are babies. I mean, they're killed at a fraction of their natural lifespan. If, you know, the reason killing is wrong or death is bad is because it deprives a being of the future they would have otherwise had, then that seems like a seriously, you know, wrong action to take. And yeah, I know. I think most people, they don't know this, but if you ate like a meat, animal that came, an animal product that was from an older animal, it doesn't taste as good. It's like a much tougher meat. Most people wouldn't enjoy it. So, the point I want to just fully reiterate is that someone who is trying to like eat humanely raised products would have to be as diligent as a vegan, because they'd have to admit. To be charitable with this argument, you'd have to admit that if you make a mistake and you accidentally eat, you know, a fast food or something, or from a restaurant where you don't know what the animal product is, you'd have to admit that you've just done something that's somewhat equivalent to torturing a dog for the sake of hearing its screams.
Stop you there. 5 minutes, Stephen.
Do you want me to talk for 5 minutes? No, I'm just kidding. That was a 5-minute warning. Sorry, you said that eating an animal would be the equivalent of hearing a dog scream. Well, I feel like there's a big difference there, because the person eating the animal is engaging in like a biologically necessary function where we eat and we know we need to eat to survive. Now, obviously, we don't need to eat animal products to survive, but I think that's a lot different than just torturing an animal for the sake of getting some kind of joyful response out of torturing the animal. I think that even when it comes to animal agriculture, this is the reason why like the PETA videos or you know whatever videos of animal ag are so effective, is because if people see somebody torturing an animal and all they see is like pain and suffering from the animal and somebody getting some kind of sick, twisted enjoyment out of it, even for an animal that we ordinarily eat, I think most people would be really uncomfortable with that. But I also, does it not bother you, or I guess how do you address or deal with the fact that, you know, in kind of like the animal kingdom, absolutely no moral systems or no moral treatment emerges from any of these animals either? So why would it be, for instance, unethical or immoral for a human to eat an animal, but it would be more ethical to leave that animal in the wilderness where another set of animals could, you know, kill it, often in kind of painful, excruciating ways, before they consume it?
Yeah, I mean, the first problem with this kind of justification for why animals don't have moral status is that, and when we look at, you know, our own human species, we find beings that are incapable of this kind of reciprocal moral behavior that you
like conservatives. I'm so joking. I'm just kidding. I'm so sorry. That was go ahead.
And we still think that these beings have moral status. You know, infants, severely cognitively disabled people, the elderly, the senile. The senile.
I understand this argument. It kind of runs into like this kind of like name the trade place. Like I would make an ontological argument here. I would say that like mankind or people kind, I don't know what we call it now, but like humanity has like these qualities to it where a fully developed person that's as realized as you can be biologically would be able to do all these things. One of these things is have the capacity for thought and reason such that moral social contracts and moral systems emerge. Now, maybe every single member of that class, for some reason, a brain injury or some other type of developmental error, isn't able to do it. But as a class of people, like we would say that we have this thing. Therefore, we treat, you know, our moral status only kind of works if we grant it to every single person in that category. We can't like pick and choose people in the category because then the whole category itself becomes suspect. So I'm not fully convinced that just because some senile or very young children are incapable of reciprocating morals means that, well, that's the same thing as the whole animal kingdom, of all of which will never reciprocate morals. I don't find that argument very convincing.
Sure. And before I address that, I just want to point out that the view you're claiming is to be that you're claiming to be more intuitive is highly unintuitive. The claim that, you know, the particular kind of being a person a being belongs to determines whether the pain that they experience matters morally is highly unintuitive, I think, to most people. I mean, suppose you woke up tomorrow and you didn't know what you were, and all you felt was just the most extreme agony you've ever experienced. It's like an unreflective agony. You're not thinking, wow, I'm in so much pain right now. I'm rational and I'm in so much pain. No, it's just extreme agony. If you ask yourself, or say you find out you're a pig or something like this, I don't know how this would be possible. I guess maybe you're behind a veil of ignorance and you like step back or something. If you find out you're a pig, should we think, wow, I guess my suffering didn't matter at all? This just seems highly unintuitive. But I guess to address your point about...
For the example, again, I find this is a form of intuition pumping, because it always feels like, imagine one day you wake up and you're just screaming in agony because you're part of a factory farm. And then the alternative reality is you could be, it's like Charlotte's Web, where you're on a, you know, a farm and everybody's happy and the spiders and the pigs and everybody get along with each other. Well, like, I'm trying to imagine what's it like living as like, you know, a deer, and you wake up and there's like a leaf that's moving and you don't know if there's like 15 animals about to jump out and eat you. And that's literally every single day of your existence for your entire life until you get old enough that something finally catches up to you and eats you and you die. I don't know what, like, I mean, like, it's hard to even imagine, you know, what is it like? You know, if I think of like a cat or a dog, I'm a bad example because I do sit on the computer all day. But for most humans, I like to go outside and see the sun and everything. Like, the idea of being locked up in a house all day seems horrible, but we consider that to be a more humane way to treat a cat than to let them roam the streets for a variety of reasons. So I understand we can intuition pump one way and say, well, this thing would definitely be bad. And it's like, I don't even know what it's like to have an experience, you know, like an animal like that. And I certainly wouldn't, because there are other experiences that they have that would be totally not okay to me, but they seem to enjoy or they seem to live in naturally. So...
Yeah, I mean, you bring up the problem of wild animal suffering, which is interesting. I mean, there are obvious disanalogies between the suffering of wild animals and the suffering we cause to animals on factory farms. I mean, for one, we cause the suffering to animals on factory farms. Animals in the wild, no moral agent is causing the suffering to another, another being, another sentient being. So maybe that plausibly explains the difference. Another thing is maybe you just accept that, like, yeah, wild animal suffering is bad, and we should do what we can to prevent wild animal suffering without, you know, preventing or without allowing some similarly bad action like destroying an ecosystem. Yeah, so maybe that's one way you could explain that.
Does this argument?
This is going to be the last comment.
Okay, I'll make a quick comment. Can I give him the last? Because I feel bad if I have the last one. Well, I feel, does this argument not collapse into like a weird like antinatalist argument where you can say, well, factory farming is bad because it introduces a lot more suffering into the world, and if you just have like the wilderness as is, then there's going to be less suffering. But like, could I make the argument, for instance, like, well, I actually think it's super ethical if you eat only cats because they're obligate carnivores, so for every one cat you eat, you're actually saving like 1,000 other animals, and then could you just not run this ad infinitum until like the larger creature you eat, the less harmful and suffering there is, until like all the animals on the planet are dead and nobody's suffering anymore, and then you can have the last crack. Yeah,
I'm not sure I follow that. I'm wondering, could you repeat?
Well, because cats have to eat other animals to survive, generally, right? They're obligate carnivores, not carnivores. Some cats are fun, but not that fun. So I'm just saying that, like, would it not be more ethical to kill or eat animals that only have to eat other animals? Like, if I eat one cat, that cat's not eating 100 other animals, so I'm reducing the suffering. And then could you just not run that same thing with every larger creature until you've eaten or eradicated everything on the planet so there's no more suffering? Like a form of, like, animal antinatalist argument.
Yeah, I mean, again, it seems implausible that you'd be able to do anything like this without destroying the ecosystem. But I mean, it's an interesting question whether we should, you know, reduce the number of natural predators in a population. I think it's irrelevant to the question of whether we should be causing massive amounts of pain and suffering to sentient beings for trivial benefits. But it is an interesting question. I'm just not sure how it fully relates to the factory farming question. And I guess, yeah, I mean, the last point I just want to emphasizes that the amount of suffering we cause to factory farmed animals in a few years is probably equivalent to the amount of suffering that every human on Earth has ever experienced in the history of humanity. This is just true if you run the numbers and you look at the neuroscientific data that suggests that non-human animals, especially land mammals, experience roughly the same amount of pain and pleasure that humans do, given the same amount of aversive stimuli. That fact makes veganism such a heavy moral imperative. I think it's an interesting question whether animals have a right to life in the way humans do, whether it's right, it's okay, it's permissible to humanely raise and kill an animal. The fact of the matter is that this is just not how the world is right now, and people should be vegan. Contingently, destiny, you should be vegan until we develop cultivated meat, better plant-based meat. So, yeah.
Thank you. Thank you, Cole. And thanks again to all our student debaters and Stephen. For those four rounds, we're going to have a few questions from the audience. If you have a question, please line up.
Actually, wait, real quick. You could just take this mic down there if you want. You just have to take it back because it's taped down a little bit. And then you can ask your first one and I'll repeat it. Go ahead.
Okay, yeah. I wanted to ask, in your debate with Ben Shapiro, one of the biggest concessions you got was that the right and you could argue the media sphere itself.
Okay. All right, sorry, speak loudly. That. Go ahead.
Should I start from the beginning or should I?
Yeah, you said in my debate with Ben Shapiro, one of the largest.
So you got a concession that Trump is graded on a curve. I agree with this proposition, but I wanted to ask what this kind of means for, in the sense, the future of politics. Will there be, if in a sense the right ends up producing a similar candidate or a candidate on the level of Trump, what will things look like for the upcoming 2028 election or the midterms in the 2026 upcoming election, and specifically targeted towards voters that are disinterested or disengaged with politics just because they see how much Trump has made things very trivial?
So when you ask like where the future of politics is going, the reason why it's hard to see beyond where we're at right now is because I don't know how much we can possibly do, and I don't know how much damage we can undo. So I think the issue that you run into is when you tell somebody that they can behave in a certain way, you set a new standard for how they'll behave. And if you allow somebody to push this boundary, if we're from 0 to 100 and the boundary is normally at 50, if they push it like all the way to 99, you're going to have to fight to bring it back to like 95, let alone back to the 50 where you would want it to be. So Republicans have just been unhinged for a long time. You know, they talk about how evil it is that we call conservatives fascists now. And I remember Michael Savage and Glenn Beck and Rush Limbaough and Sean Hannity and Billy Cunningham and all these.
Are you Jesse Waters right now?
Well, yeah. It's like screaming like communist, and, socialist, yeah. Or whatever. So yeah. The issue is that like, now obviously I do it in a far more inflammatory way, you know, saying basically sure. Like, well, if you're going to act like this, then the other side could act like this. And I don't think you want that. So maybe we should all like take a step back and go back to where we're all being like nice to each other, because that's a better world for everybody. But we have to find a way it's such a boring topic, but it goes back to this misinformation thing, because something that one of the debate opponents brought up earlier related to the rhetoric thing is, well, the other side thinks that the liberals have already done done this. And that's an issue. That's a fact-based issue.
Yeah.
And as long as one side has been able to hijack like what is real and what is true in so many people's minds, if I can invent the past for you, I can justify any future I want because I can show you these things have happened and these people have justified it. Therefore, you're justified in acting the same. So I would hope that politics somewhat goes back to normal, but it's going to require half the country to completely wake up from the Lulu land they've been living in under Trump too, that we're only not even 1 year into.
Yeah.
And then it's going to require us to acknowledge as a country, there's a lot of foreign players that have a big motivation in how our politics plays out. And there's a lot of bad incentives that exist right now in the United States that the average person can't navigate our media landscape and expect to see what's real and true because we just don't naturally select for that. We select for things that make us feel good.
Agreed.
Okay, awesome. Thanks.
I'd love to debate you sometime.
Sure. You should have signed up for this.
Hi, Stephen. Thanks so much. So I'm not a vegan, but I was kind of surprised about some of these answers, and I kind of want to go down at least one of the answers that you gave for some of this. So you seem to privilege human sentience and qualify it with abstract reasoning over phenomenological consciousness. And the type of consciousness where we know is conserved in animals, where the nociceptors are the same, the thalamocortical loops are the same, limbic systems are the same, the mechanics of misery are the same. The inference that the capacity for suffering is conserved, you don't seem to actually address these sorts of arguments around why shouldn't we care about this? You sort of answer, well, they're not human.
I mean, there seems to be something different in kind to the human mental experience than there is to the animal mental experience. I mean, we can point to a lot of similar structures and a lot of similar, you know, underlying mechanisms, but for some reason, things like culture, things like morality, things like, you know, complex thought and speech have just never emerged. So it seems like there's significantly something different in kind there. Now, would I say that there's like a 100% chance that there's no conscious experience happening that is happening in a mind like ours? I mean, I can't say that with certainty, but I think that the vegan overstate their argument and saying, well, there's enough similarity here that for sure they definitely get more consideration.
Well, to be fair, it doesn't seem like the similarities that is being stated there isn't the fact that they're the same or they're able to do tax code or write speeches and stuff like that, but the capacity to actually suffer is a thing that is conserved. And the fact that things are different and there's something different in the complexity of our behavior doesn't seem to be warrant for torturing people.
I mean, maybe not. I guess you could explore that further. I would argue that suffering is generally bad for people, but I think that we just kind of like take that for granted because of how our lives exist today. Like, I mean, I could hypothesize like the ideal optimal human life would be at 10 years old, you continually take enough morphine or something until eventually you die in like some euphoric blissed out state of drug overdoseness. And, you know, if you're just graphing somebody's life in terms of like optimal happiness, it's probably about as happy as you could be. But I don't think that would be a very satisfying answer to a lot of people in terms of satisfying like a person's life. Like, I don't think that we measure like pain and suffering and like happiness and joy on just this like very collapsed axis of like, are you in pain or not in pain?
Well,
so
it seems like what we
or you can do one last thing, I guess, or why I feel bad.
Do instead of like a very simple description what you just said is we care about the capacity for the experience there and put that the foremost what we consider. So if we learned that like some action or some peanut butter is now causing cancer to kids, it's that knowledge that actually invites the moral obligation to do something about it. It's the capacity to actually inflict diminishing well-being on some other conscious entity that we really care about.
Okay, thanks, I appreciate it.
Hi, Destiny. My name's Arik. I'm a bit of a fan, but my question is, since we can use history to help direct our future, where do you see the root of the collective psychosis of the right? Like, how do we prevent another Trump 30, 40, or whatever years from now? What was wrong with our country that led to all of this?
This is like a question that will probably be studied for a long time, and there's going to be people way smarter than me that have answers to this. But like, I would argue that a big thing that happened was, I would say in a way, like a microcosm or a macrocosm, like the argument that I had earlier of like, well, you don't want to be just like them, that's like a microcosm of, I think, what's happened with liberals and conservatives over the past like 30 years of this country, to where liberals have been expected to govern both like morally and in a way where they can communicate the rightness of what they're doing. And conservatives have just been expected to kind of show up and then just like do their song and dance. And, you know, however they govern, who actually cares? Although now they don't even have to show up and dance. Now they just get on social media or they hide on military bases and they tweet unhinged stuff. So, for example, like when I look like historically, if you want to talk about the economy, really, if you want to talk about anything, I don't think it's an accident that we had a massive economic collapse at the end of the Bush regime, where we had the 2007-2008 global financial crisis, and then Obama has to come in at the tail end of that, clean all of that up, right the American economy, and then get everything working again. And then for some reason, after two terms of that, then Trump gets to come in, right off all of that, you know, even though things like his illegal immigration was higher than Obama's ever was before COVID hit, his budget deficits were increasingly past where Obama's was when Obama left office. None of that mattered. COVID came in. His response was terrible. I'm not saying it should have been a perfect response, but like it was measurably terrible in a ton of different ways. He lied about the number of infections. He constantly downplayed it. He admitted to downplaying it. And then after Trump was gone, then a liberal, Biden had to come in, clean things up, kind of like right the ship, get things going again. And then now a Republican president is coming again and is like making a mess of things. When you have a world where one side is expected to lead and govern and has to act in a moral way, and the other side gets to come in and just knock everything over, and we're not allowed to tell ourselves an honest history of what happened at the end of the day, you are destroying people's ability to learn and to actually have informed decisions going forward about what they want their leadership to look like. Because the collective delusion we have to live in is, I would argue, I'm not trying to argue too much for the other speaker because it's weirder than out of here, but like this, they say, like, well, you guys need to be more civil. It's not fair when you do the same things they're doing. I would argue that that thought process has driven liberal politics for the past two decades, and it's why we're here now, because we've allowed the other side to live in this delusional fantasy land where they think they've governed appropriately, like the Democrats have, but they haven't. They've made a mess of things constantly, and we're constantly expected to pretend otherwise. And I think that's why we're where we're at right now.
Right. Thank you. Yeah. Okay. Thank you.
Hey, Destiny.
Hi.
So we agree on a lot, so I want to do something a little spicy. So in the vegan debate, it seems to me that you're removing animals like entirely from your moral framework. So I'm wondering, how do you justify animal cruelty laws? It seems the way you did it in the debate was by saying that it predicts behavior in the future, but it seems to me that that's not really how our criminal law works. Like, we don't try to criminalize things because we predict that someone will do some negative action in the future.
I don't know if I would justify animal cruelty laws. There's a lot that goes into that. It's an intuitive thing that a lot of people just have a feeling about, but I am who I am. So, but I don't know. Like, I think, like, I always make fun of people that are meat eaters that get like really mad about Cecil the lion or some dog or cat being, you know, killed when they're totally content eating chicken nuggets and cheeseburgers all day. I think it's a huge hypocrisy from some people. There's also laws against, you know, sodomy all over the place, and there's probably a lot of laws that I couldn't justify personally. So, yeah.
Okay. So you don't agree with animal cruelty laws?
I don't know. Like, insofar as they might be predictive of crazy future behavior, maybe. I don't know if we ever have any other law like that. I'm not sure. I guess okay. I don't think. But yeah, I'm kind of indifferent to all of that stuff. Yeah.
Yeah, that's consistent. Thanks.
And for our final question.
Hey. Gotta save the best for last.
Hi.
Hello, Stephen. Thank you for visiting us here today at Yale. And I'd like to ask you, if the average American suddenly became significantly smarter and more emotionally intelligent, how do you think political communication and strategy would have to adapt? Also, how do you think the current American populace, mainly non-politicians, would look back at the current administration's actions and rhetoric and put that down in the history books?
Man, that's a hard one. If we all, Joe Rogan and Candace Owens would immediately lose 90% of their audience, I would say, is the first thing. No. I don't know. That's a hard one. If everybody, it's also kind of a selfish thing, because obviously we all imagine ourselves to be the enlightened ones, you know, in terms of what everything would, you know, everybody would look like me or think like me. The thing, I'll speak about it in this way. The thing that I think that we lose the most is that I don't necessarily think everybody needs to agree with me on everything, but there are some things that we should agree on, like ways to arrive like at epistemically sound positions, being able to evaluate news and stuff, and we should be able to have an argument over things where the conversation is rooted in like actual real fact, and then we can have a debate on where things should go from there. So like, I think it's an interesting conversation about like housing, or COVID is one that I bring up a lot, right? Were the lockdowns too aggressive? Should there have been vaccine mandates or not? I think that there are really compelling arguments between intellectually honest people on both sides of that conversation. There's something to be said for like, can the government really tell me that I have to inject something into my body? You know, like that's a statement that a lot of people just assume is, well, no, I'm completely anti-government mandates, but that's not true. If there was a virus that, you know, lurked silently in your body for 2 weeks and then had a 90% kill rate, I think the most libertarian person in the world would say, you absolutely need to mandate vaccines, or I should be able to kill you if I think you're infected. Like, people would go to that level. But then, you know, when the disease becomes less significant, people start to pretend their principles are changing when it's actually more like an outcome-oriented question. So, yeah, I think the biggest thing that we've lost by not being a little bit more, I don't know if you call them emotionally or intellectually intelligent about things, but we've lost the ability to debate policy, and we're just constantly getting stuck on debating reality. You know, like, is it Ukraine's fault that Russia invaded, rather than, you know, what are the reasons why both sides might be fighting with each other, and what should we be doing to alleviate those reasons? Or, you know, like, is Israel like a bloody apartheid state that's only interested in genociding as many Arabs as possible? Or, you know, is there a complicated interplay between the history of both of these people that other players internationally have fit into in a negative sense in both sides? And, like, what can we do to alleviate the suffering, you know, especially on the Palestinian side? I would imagine, looking back on this era, the biggest disagreement or the biggest issue is that you're not having, like, real conversations about literally anything. All of my debate that I had 3 days ago with a couple lawyers about the Venezuelan boat strikes, you know, one guy was screeching that shipwrecks aren't blown up ships, they're just ships that get wrecked, like in Pirates of the Caribbean, they like crash on rocks. And I'm like, this isn't a real conversation. This is the most delusional stuff I've ever heard in my entire life. And every single conversation is like that. You know, why did you pardon this one guy who's this crypto billionaire? I don't even know who you're talking about. And then he just moves, Trump just moves on. So yeah, I think that's the biggest issue, is our inability to even have a back and forth on things. Because I'm not right on everything, just like 99% of things. But like, I recognize that there are people that could disagree with me on the other side, and then we could have like an interesting convo back and forth, rather than us having to argue, you know, like, is the earth flat, or did we go to the moon, or is the French government really putting hits out on Candace Owens, or is Macron's wife actually another husband? And it's just so stupid. Yeah, and these are the most popular podcasters on the planet. It's really sad, I think. Yeah.
Beautifully said. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you very much.
We're going to end it here for tonight. On behalf of Yale Effective Altruism, I want to thank Stephen Minnell for coming to campus and debating with us. Thank you as well to our debaters, Hassan Kadir, Sherry Huang, Hannah Owens-Pierre, Cole Haynes, and to our moderator, Giuseppe DiMassa, and to all the volunteers who helped with this event. Thank you for coming, thank you for listening, and engaging with the arguments. Please exit the hall calmly so we can hear the room and break up down the setup. Have a good night.